Volume 2, Number 170, The Sermon of the Mount, The Beatitudes, Part 1. Jesus speaks to the apostles, allotting a place to each one, so that they may direct and watch over the crowd who are climbing up the mountain since the early hours in the morning, with sick people, whom they carry in their arms or in stretchers, or who have dragged themselves along on crutches. Among the people there are Stephen and Hermas. The air is clear and rather chilly, but the sun soon softens the fresh mountain air, which on its turn moderates the heat of the sun, drawing benefit from it as it becomes pure and cool, but not sharp. The people sit on the stones scattered in the little valley between the two crests, but some wait for the sun to dry the grass, wet with dew, so that they may sit down on the earth. There is a huge crowd from all the districts in Palestine, and the people are of all conditions. The apostles disappear in the multitude, but like bees that come and go from the meadows to the beehives, now and again they go back to the master to inform him, to ask for advice, and for the pleasure of being seen near him. Jesus climbs a little higher up than the meadow, which is at the bottom of the little valley. He leans against the rock and begins speaking. Many have asked me during a year of preaching, "You say that you are the Son of God. Tell us, what is heaven? What is the kingdom? What is God?" Because our notions are hazy. We know that there is heaven with God and the angels, but no one has ever come to tell us what it is like, because it is closed to righteous people. They have also asked me what the kingdom is and what God is. And I have endeavored to explain to you what the kingdom is and what God is. I have striven not because it was difficult for me to give an explanation, but because it is difficult for many reasons to get you to accept the truth that clashes, as far as the kingdom is concerned, with a multitude of ideas which have risen over the centuries, and as far as God is concerned, with the sublimity of his nature. Others have also asked me, "All right, that is the kingdom, and that is God, but how do we achieve them?" Here again, I have tried to explain to you patiently the true spirit of the law of Sinai. Who abides by that spirit conquers heaven. But to explain the law of Sinai to you, it is necessary to make you hear the loud thunder of the lawgiver and of his prophet, who, while promising blessings to obedient believers, threaten terrible punishments and maledictions to those who disobey. The epiphany of Sinai was frightful, and its dreadfulness is reflected in the entire law, and has been reflected throughout centuries and in all souls. But God is not only a legislator. God is a Father, and a Father of immense goodness. Probably, nay, certainly, your souls are not in a position to rise and contemplate the infinite perfections of God, and his goodness least of all, because goodness and love are the rarest virtues amongst men. The reason is that your souls are weakened by original sin, by passions, by your own sins, by your own selfishness, and the selfishness of other people. The former closes your souls, the latter irritates them. Goodness, how sweet it is to be good, with no hatred, no envy, and no pride. How sweet it is to have eyes that look only for love, and hands that stretch out only in gestures of love, and lips that utter only words of love, and a heart, above all a heart, that, full only of love, urges eyes, hands, and lips to acts of love. The most learned amongst you know with which gifts God had enriched Adam, both for himself and for his descendants. Also the most ignorant amongst the children of Israel know that there is a soul in us. Only the poor heathens are unaware of this royal guest, of this vital breath and celestial light that sanctifies and gives life to our body. But the most learned know which gifts were given to man and to the soul of man. God was not less munificent to the soul than to the flesh and blood of the creature made by him, with a little mud in his breath. As he gave the natural gifts of beauty and integrity, of intelligence and willpower, and the capability of loving oneself and other people, he also gave moral gifts and the subjection of senses to reason. Therefore, the wicked captivity of senses and passions did not permeate the freedom and control of Adam and of his will, with which God had gifted him. Thus he was free to love, free to wish, free to enjoy injustice without what makes you slaves, causing you to feel the bite of the poison that Satan spread and which now overflows, carrying you out of the limpid riverbed on to the slimy fields and putrescent ponds, where the fever of carnal and moral senses fermentates. Because you must realize that also the concupiscence of thought is sensual, and they received supernatural gifts, that is, sanctifying grace, a heavenly destiny, the vision of God. Sanctifying grace, the life of the soul, the most spiritual thing deposited in our spiritual soul, the grace that makes us children of God, because it preserves us from the death of sin, and who is not dead lives in the house of the Father, paradise, in my kingdom, heaven. What is this grace that sanctifies and gives life and kingdom? Oh, not many words are required. Grace is love. Grace is therefore God. It is God who, admiring himself in the creature whom he created perfect, loves himself, contemplates himself, desires himself, gives himself what is his own to multiply it, to delight in the multiplication, to love himself in the many others who are others himself. Oh, my children, do not defraud God of this right of his. Do not deprive God of what belongs to him. Do not disappoint God in his desire. Consider that he acts out of love. Even if you did not exist, he would still be infinite, and his power would not diminish. But he, although he is complete in his infinite immeasurable measure, does not want anything for himself and in himself, which he could not because he is already infinite, but for creation, his creature. He wants to increase his love for all rational creatures contained in creation, and therefore gives you his grace, love, that you may carry it in yourselves to the perfection of saints, and you may pour this treasure, taken from the treasure that God has given you with his grace, and increased by all the holy deeds and all your heroic lives of saints, into the infinite ocean where God is, into heaven. You are divine reservoirs of love. That is what you are, and no death is given to your being, because you are eternal, as God is, being like God. You shall be, and there will be no end to your being, because you are immortal, like the holy spirits that super-nourished you, returning to you enriched by their own merits. You live and nourish. You live and enrich. You live and form the most holy thing, which is the communion of the spirits, from God, the most perfect spirit, down to the last-born baby, who sucks his mother's breast for the first time. Do not criticize me in your hearts, O learned men. Do not say, "He's crazy, he's a liar," because he speaks foolishly, saying that there is grace in us, when sin has deprived us of it. He lies, stating that we are already one thing with God. Yes, there is sin and there is separation. But before the power of the Redeemer, sin, the cruel separation between the father and the children, will collapse like a wall shaken by a new Samson. I have already got hold of it, and I am shaking it, and it is about to fall, and Satan is trembling with wrath and impotence, as he can avail nothing against my power, and he realizes that so much prey is being snatched from him, and that it is becoming more difficult to drag man to sin. Because when I will have taken you to my Father through me, and you have been cleansed and strengthened by my blood and sorrow, grace will come back to you, lively and powerful, and you will be triumphant, if you so wish. God does no violence to your thoughts or your sanctification. You are free, but he gives you back your strength. He gives you back your freedom from Satan's empire. It is up to you to take upon yourselves the infernal yoke or to put angelical wings on your souls. It depends on you. With me as your brother to guide you and nourish you with an immortal food. You may ask, how can one conquer God and his kingdom through a milder road than the harsh Sinai one? There is no other road but that one. But let us look at it not from the point of view of a threat, but from the point of view of love. Let us not say, "Woe to me if I do not do that," trembling with fear of sinning, of not being able not to sin. But let us say, "How glad I will be if I do that," and with the impulse of a supernatural joy, full of happiness, let us rush towards these beatitudes, brought about by compliance with the law, as roses sprout from a thorny bush. How happy I will be if I am poor in spirit, because mine shall be the kingdom of heaven. How happy I will be if I am gentle, because I shall have the earth for my heritage. How happy I will be if I mourn without rebelling, because I will be comforted. How happy I will be if I hunger and thirst for justice more than I do for bread and wine to satisfy the flesh, because justice will satisfy me. How happy I will be if I am merciful, because I will have divine mercy shown me. How happy I will be if I'm pure in heart, because God will bend over my pure heart, and I will see him. How happy I will be if I am peaceful in spirit, because God will call me his son, because love is in peace, and God is love, who loves whoever is like him. How happy I will be if I am persecuted in the cause of right, because God, my Father, to reward me for my earthly persecutions, will give me the kingdom of heaven. How happy I will be if I am abused and accused falsely for being your son, O God. It must not cause me desolation, but joy, as it will make me equal to your best servants, to the prophets who were persecuted for the same reason, and with whom I firmly believe I shall share the same great eternal reward in heaven, which is mine. Let us look thus at the way of salvation through the joy of saints. How happy I will be if I am poor in spirit. Oh, satanic thirst for wealth, to what frenzy you lead both rich and poor. The rich who live for their gold, the ill-famed idol of their ruined spirits, the poor who live hating the rich because of their gold, and even if they do not murder them physically, they curse the rich, wishing them all sorts of evil. It is not enough not to do evil. One must not even wish to do it. He who curses wishing calamities and death is very like him who kills physically, because he wishes the death of the person he hates. I solemnly tell you that such a wish is like an action held back. It is like a fetus conceived in a womb and formed, but not yet ejected. A wicked desire corrupts and ruins man, because it lasts longer than a violent action and is deeper than the action itself. If a rich man is poor in spirit, he does not sin for the sake of his gold, but he turns his gold into sanctification, because he turns it into love. Loved and blessed, he is like spring water that saves travelers in a desert as he gives generously, without avarice, happy to be able to relieve desperate situations. If he is poor, he is happy in his poverty and eats his bread, which is sweetened by the joy of being free from the thirst of gold. He sleeps free from nightmares and gets up well rested for his tranquil work, which is always light when done without greed or envy. What makes man materially rich is gold. What makes him morally rich are his affections. Gold comprises not only money, but also houses, fields, jewels, furniture, herds, everything. In other words, that which makes life wealthy materially. Affections include blood or marriage ties, friendship, intellectual soundness, public offices. As you can see, if for the first group a poor man can say, "Oh, as far as I'm concerned, providing I do not envy those who are rich, I'm all right because I'm poor, and thus I am settled by force of circumstances." With regard to the second group, also a poor man must be careful, because also the poorest man can become sinfully rich in spirit. Who is immoderately attached to a thing commits a sin. You may say, "Are we then to hate the wealth that God granted us? Why then does he command us to love our fathers, mothers, wives, children, and say, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself'?" You must distinguish. We must love our fathers, mothers, wives, and our neighbor, but in the degree indicated by God, as ourselves. Whereas God is to be loved above everything and with our whole selves. We must not love God as we love the dearest people among our neighbors, because a woman suckled us, or because she sleeps on our chest and procreates children for us. But we must love him with our whole selves, that is, with all the ability to love that is in man. The love of a son, of a husband, of a friend, and, do not be scandalized, the love of a father. Yes, we must have for the interests of God the same care that a father has for his children, for whom he lovingly protects his wealth and increases it, and he takes care of and is anxious for their physical growth and intellectual education and for their success in the world. Love is not an evil and must not become an evil. The graces which God grants us are not evil and must not become so. They are love, granted out of love. We must make a loving use of such wealth granted to us by God in personal affections and in worldly goods. And only he who does not make an idol of such wealth, but uses it to serve God in holiness, shows that he has no sinful attachment to it. One then practices that holy poverty in spirit that deprives itself of everything in order to be more free to conquer God, the holy, supreme wealth. To conquer God, that is, to have the kingdom of heaven. How happy I will be if I am gentle. This may seem to be in contrast with the facts of daily life. Those who are not lowly seem to be prominent and successful in their families, towns, and countries. But is theirs a real triumph? No, it is not. It is fear that keeps apparently subdued those who are overwhelmed by the despot. But in actual fact, it is nothing but a veil drawn over the rebellion seething against the tyrant. Irascible and overbearing people do not win the love of their relatives, of their own citizens, or of their subjects. Neither are intellects or souls convinced to follow the doctrines of masters who impose themselves by stating, "I said so, thus it is." Such masters only create self-taught men seeking the key that can open the closed doors of a wisdom or of a science which they feel to be, and actually is, the opposite of what is imposed on them. Those priests who do not endeavor to conquer souls by means of a patient, humble, and loving kindness do not win any souls to God, but they look like armed warriors who start a fierce attack, such as their intolerant rashness in dealing with souls. Oh, poor souls! If they were holy, they would not need you, O priests, to reach the light. They would already have it within themselves. If they were just, they would not need you, O judges, to be put under the restraint of justice, as they would already have justice within themselves. If they were healthy, they would not need a doctor. Be therefore gentle. Do not put souls to flight. Attract them through love, because lowliness is love, as poverty in spirit is love. If you are such, you will have the earth for your heritage, and you will take this place to God, whereas before it belonged to Satan. Because your lowliness, which besides love is also humility, will have overcome hatred and pride, expelling from souls the vile king of hatred and pride, and the world will belong to you, that is, to God, because you will be the just souls that will acknowledge God as the absolute master of creation, to whom praise and blessing are due, and everything else which belongs to him. How happy I will be if I mourn without rebelling. Sorrow is on the earth, and sorrow wrings tears from men. Sorrow did not exist, but man brought it onto the earth, and because of his corrupt intellect, he continuously strives to increase it in every possible way. Besides diseases and calamities ensuing from thunderbolts, storms, avalanches, earthquakes, man, in order to suffer, and above all, to make other people suffer, because we would like only other people to suffer and not ourselves, the effects of means studied to make people suffer. Man invents deadly weapons, which are more and more dreadful, and moral hardships, which are more and more cunning. How many tears man wrings from his fellow man through the instigation of his secret king, Satan. And I solemnly tell you that those tears are not an impairment, but a perfection of man. Man is an absent-minded child, a thoughtless, superficial child, a backward-born child, until tears make him an adult, thoughtful, intelligent person. Only those who weep or have wept know how to love and can understand. They know how to love their weeping brothers, how to understand them in their grief, how to help them with their goodness, which is fully aware how bitter it is to weep alone. And they know how to love God, because they have realized that everything is grief except God, because they have understood that sorrow can be soothed if tears are shed on God's heart. And they have also realized that resigned tears, which do not cause faith to be lost or prayer to become barren, and which loathe rebellion, such resigned tears change nature, and instead of sorrow, they become comfort. Yes, those who weep loving the Lord will be comforted. How happy I will be if I hunger and thirst for justice. From the moment he is born to the moment he dies, man craves eagerly for food. He opens his mouth at his birth to get hold of his mother's nipple. He opens his lips to swallow some refreshment in the throes of death. He works to feed himself. He makes a huge nipple of the world from which he sucks insatiably for that which is perishable. But what is man? An animal? No, he is a son of God. He is an exile for a few or many years, but his life does not come to an end when he changes his dwelling. There is a life in life, as there is a kernel in a nut. The shell is not the nut, but it is the kernel inside the shell that is the nut. If you sow a shell, nothing will come up. But if you sow the shell with the kernel inside it, a big tree will grow. The same applies to man. It is not his flesh that becomes immortal, but his soul, and it is to be nourished to take it to immortality, to which the soul, out of love, will take the body in the blessed resurrection. Wisdom and justice are the nourishment of the soul. They are taken as food and as drink, and they strengthen, and the more one takes of them, the more grows the holy eagerness to possess wisdom and know justice. But the day will come when the holy insatiable hunger of the soul will be satisfied. It will come. God will give himself to his child and will suckle him, and the child destined for paradise will be satisfied with the admirable mother who is God himself. And man will never be hungry again, but will rest happily on God's divine bosom. No human science is equal to this divine science. The curiosity of the mind can be gratified, but the necessities of the spirit cannot. Nay, the spirit is disgusted by the difference in taste and makes a wry mouth at the bitter nipple, preferring to suffer the pangs of hunger rather than be filled with a food that does not come from God. Be not afraid, O men thirsting or starving for God. Be faithful, and you will be satisfied by him who loves you. How happy I will be if I am merciful. Who amongst men can say, I do not need mercy? No one. Now, if in the old law it is written, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, Why should we not say in the new law, who has been merciful shall find mercy? Everybody needs forgiveness. Well then, forgiveness is not achieved by formulae or by the form of a rite, which are external symbols granted to man's dull mentality. It is instead obtained through the internal rite of love, which is still mercy. If the sacrifice of a goat or a lamb and the offer of a few coins were prescribed, the reason is that every evil is founded on two roots, greed and pride. Greed is punished through the expense for the purchase of the offering, pride by the open confession of the right. I am making this sacrifice because I have sinned. It is also done to anticipate the times and the signs of the times, and in the blood which is shed is symbolized the blood which will be shed to cancel the sins of men. Blessed, therefore, are those who are merciful to those who are hungry, nude, homeless, to those who suffer from the greatest misery, which is to have a bad disposition, as it causes grief both to those who have it and to those who live with them. Be merciful. Forgive. Bear with people. Help them. Teach them. Support them. Do not conceal yourselves in a crystal tower, saying, I am pure, and I will not descend among sinners. Do not say, I am rich and happy, and I will not hear of other people's miseries. Remember that your richness, your health, your family wealth may vanish quicker than smoke blown away by a strong wind. And remember that crystal acts as a lens, and consequently, what may be unnoticed if you were mixed among the crowds cannot be concealed if you place yourselves in a crystal tower where you are alone, isolated, and illumined on all sides. Mercy is necessary to offer a continuous, secret, holy sacrifice of expiation and to obtain mercy. How happy I will be if I am pure in heart. God is purity. Paradise is the kingdom of purity. Nothing impure can enter paradise where God is. Therefore, if you are impure, you will not be able to enter the kingdom of God. Oh, but what a joy the Father grants to his children in advance. Who is pure has, in this world, an advance of heaven, because God bends over a pure soul, and man, from the earth, can see his God. He is not familiar with the taste of human love, but relishes the flavor of divine love to the point of being enraptured, and can say, I am with you, and you are in me. I, therefore, possess you, and I recognize you as the most loving spouse of my soul. And believe me, who has God enjoys substantial changes of which he himself is unaware, and thus becomes holy, wise, strong. Words embellish his lips, and his actions acquire a strength that is not of the creature, but comes from God who lives in it. What is the life of those who see God? A beatitude. And do you wish to deprive yourselves of such a gift for the sake of fetid impurities? How happy I will be if I am peaceful in spirit. Peace is one of God's characteristics. God is to be found only in peace, because peace is love. Whereas war is hatred. Satan is hatred. God is peace. No man can say that he is the Son of God. Neither can God call son a man who has an irascible soul always ready to stir up a storm. Not only, neither can he be called the Son of God, who, although not a troublemaker himself, by means of his own great peace, does not help to calm the storm stirred up by other people. Who is peaceful propagates peace also without uttering any words. Master of himself, and, I dare say, master of God, he divulges him as a lamp spreads its light, as a thurible exhales its perfume, as a wineskin holds wine, and this sweet oil, which is the spirit of peace issuing from the children of God, gives light in the foggy gloominess of ill feelings, and purifies the air from the miasmas of malice, and calms the raging waves of quarrels. Let God and men say that you are so. How happy I will be if I am persecuted in the cause of right. Man has become so devilish that he hates good wherever it is, and he hates who is good, as if who is good, even when silent, accuses and reproaches him. In fact, the goodness of one person makes the wickedness of a wicked person appear even more wicked. In fact, the faith of a true believer makes the hypocrisy of a false believer appear more clearly. In fact, he who by his way of living continuously bears witness to justice can but be hated by the unjust. And then the unjust are pitiless towards the lovers of justice. The same applies here as in wars. Man makes more progress in the satanic art of persecution than in the holy art of love. But he can persecute only what has a short life. What is eternal in man eludes the snare. Nay, it achieves a more energetic vitality than persecution itself. Life escapes through the bleeding wounds or because of the privations that consume those who are persecuted. But the blood makes the purple of the future king, and the privations are as many steps to ascend the thrones that the Father has prepared for his martyrs, for whom are reserved the royal seats in the kingdom of heaven. How happy I will be if I am accused and abused falsely. Strive to have your names written in the celestial books where names are not written according to human falsehood, which is accustomed to praise those who less deserve praise, where instead, with justice and love, are written the deeds of good people, in order to give them the reward promised to the blessed ones by God. In the past, the prophets were calumniated and abused, but when the gates of heaven are opened, they will enter the city of God like imposing kings, and the angels will bow singing out of joy. You, too, who have been abused and accused falsely for being the children of God, will have a heavenly triumph, and when the time comes to an end and paradise is full, then every tear will be dear to you, because through it you will have conquered the eternal glory, which I promise you in the name of the Father. Go, I will speak to you again tomorrow. Only the sick people should remain, that I may relieve them from their pains. Peace be with you, and may the meditation on salvation lead you, through love, on to the road, the end of which is heaven.